It's 9 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Movie Talk is coming up. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men, real clothing for real people, proud to sponsor the important voice of KBOO. Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizzicato pizza, and all-new seating, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Good morning out there. My name is Ed Goldberg. I'm here with my friend and colleague,
Dawn Taylor.
And DK is taking the rest of the month off, as I will be taking half of January off, but that's another matter. We have no announcements today. We do have a bunch of films. Give me 30 seconds on whether you thought 2005 was a good year for movies or not.
Much better than the year before. I had to write up a top 10 list, and I found myself actually slopping over. I saw a lot of good movies this year.
Okay.
I mean, still, 90% of it was dreck, but that 10% that was actually good, I think, was actually quite good.
Dawn, 90% of everything is dreck.
Yes.
Yeah, except... Well, no, I'm not going to get myself into trouble for saying that. Let's start with Memoirs of a Geisha. I saw this one. I took the bullet for us on this one. This is a very popular novel. The movie is directed by Rob Marshall. It stars, I don't know why this causes trouble. They have Italian people playing Greek people, and they have Jewish people playing Italian people, but there was a problem here with Chinese people playing Japanese people. Okay. I don't understand the problem, but it's Zia Zhang, Michelle Yeoh, Ken Watanabe, who is actually Japanese, and Gong Li, who is Chinese. This is a gorgeous, badly acted film. Can you imagine getting a Christmas present with the most beautiful wrappings on it? It's just, you hate to tear the paper to get to the package. And when you open it, it's empty. That's this movie. It's a soap opera. The soap opera is a pretty tedious little story. It involves geishas, and we all want to know a little bit about geishas. Everything you need to know about geishas in about a half an hour, and then after that, the movie just is Days of Our Lives as the stomach turns, it's that. Unrequited love and longing for years and years, and, bad women being bad to nice girls, and it's love and vicious competition in a geisha house, I guess, for want of a better
See, that actually sounds fun.
Well, it would be fun maybe in different hands. Ken Watanabe is a fairly good actor, but Gong Li has a shrill one-note performance, so that every time she comes out on the screen you cringe. At least I did. Anyway, you want her part to be over as quickly as possible. And not only is it shrill in one note, it's also wooden. There's no soul in it at all. Maybe that was supposed to be what the idea was. Zia Zhang, who is, she does quite well. She's played as a young girl, and this character is played as a young girl and as an older woman by Zhang. And the character itself is, she's sold by her father to the geisha houses. Her sister isn't quite as pretty as she is, so she winds up in the houses of prostitution, and then they turn her into a geisha, and it's a lot of grunt work before you actually put on those cute little shoes and mince around the streets. I couldn't wait for this movie to be over, in spite of the fact that it's full of gorgeous people and gorgeous clothing and all this kind of stuff. Give the movie a C-. If you really, really love the book, maybe you want to see the movie. I have to defend Zhi Zhang by saying she's really not comfortable enough in English yet to convey the kinds of things she needs to convey. She's fine in Chinese films. She's excellent in Chinese films.
That was my question, because one thing I had heard someone else mention is that part of the problem with the acting could also be the fact you've got Chinese actors attempting to do Japanese accents, and that but I don't know. I mean, there is a difference in the accent.
Now, Michelle Yeoh speaks unaccented English. She's an English speaker. She speaks both English and Chinese from youth. Gong Li, who speaks English fairly well, is just not. She didn't hit the character.
Any director Rob Marshall just isn't quite. He doesn't have the chops for it.
I don't think he was up for this one. No, that's it. So that was Memoirs of a Geisha. The next one, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada.
I wanted to see this. I had heard good things about this.
Well, okay, it's directed by Tommy Lee Jones, which might be his first directing effort.
I think it is.
Yeah. Starring Jones and Barry Pepper, Julio Cedillo, January Jones, Melissa Leo. So good to see Melissa Leo again, even in a small part. And Dwight Yoakam, whose music I can't stand, but is actually a fairly good actor. This is a John Sayles movie without John Sayles. I mean, that's the only way I can describe it. It's a really passionate story about a complicated relation between Texans and their Mexican hired help. Melquiades Estrada is a Mexican cowboy who gets hired by Tommy Lee Jones to do some work, and in a series of stupidity and misunderstanding, he gets shot to death. And his body is buried three times because one time it's buried just to get rid of it. And then Tommy Lee Jones, who feels a compassion for his friend, Tommy Lee Jones is the guy who hired him. And for his friend, he tries to get him buried where he was supposed to be buried, in his home in Mexico. And therein lies the deep irony at the end of the film, which I won't say anything about. And in fact, speaking of irony, it's laid on quite a bit thick. This is steel-plated irony. And it becomes pretty tendentious. By the end of the film, you pretty much know what's going on with this thing. And the twist at the end, you're saying, yeah, all right. Jones's heart is in the right place, but it comes off as, you know, like I say, this is John Sayles' wastebasket is where this story was found. Good acting mostly, not hard to sit through, but I wanted this movie to be better. You'll want it to be better. Give it a B-. I don't know. I might kick it up to a B, but certainly no higher than that. That's The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. Tell us about the producers, the much-anticipated producers.
The much-anticipated producers. First there came the 1968 Mel Brooks film starring Zira Mostel and Gene Wilder about two producers, one a producer and the other his accountant, who discovered that it would be more financially enriching to produce a Broadway flop. And then, you know, sucker in a lot of people to pony up the money for like 1,000% of the cost of the play, and then have it bomb, and you don't have to pay anybody back. So they come up with the play Springtime for Hitler and put it on as this huge bombastic musical. And then there came the Broadway show based on this, with songs written by Mel Brooks, which I saw the road production here in Portland, and it was a good little show. It, you know, the thing is, it's a Broadway musical. It was light, it was fluffy, it took all of the main points from the movie and added more songs, and there were production numbers, and watching a lot of it on stage was a lot of fun. And now there's the film of the Broadway show with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, who played the roles on Broadway. And there's a sort of dilution of genius effect at work, where you've got a really wonderful movie that's made into a very good Broadway show, which is made into a so-so movie that's essentially just a record of the play. It's directed by Susan Stroman, who directed the Broadway show. It's not directed by Brooks, and it shows. It's staged like the play. It's hardly opened up at all. There's a few scenes where they take it out into Central Park, but essentially you've got a three-walled set that is the exact same set as the stage production, with the exact same business and the exact same acting. And unfortunately, that means it doesn't really work for the most part as a play, as a film. Some of the secondary characters are wonderful. Will Ferrell, who you despise, is actually pretty good. I've always liked him much better in secondary roles and as a leading man. And he plays Franz Liebkin, the playwright who wrote Springtime for Hitler, and he's very funny. The two gentlemen, Gary Beach and Roger Bart, who play the cross-dressing director, Roger Debris, and his assistant, Carmen Gia, are hilarious. They're wonderful. Then you have Nathan Lane, who is essentially channeling Zero Mostel and trying to do Zero Mostel, and he's all over the place, and he's very loud, and he's very bombastic, and he's Nathan Lane. If you like Nathan Lane being very big, you'll like this. And he's playing opposite Matthew Broderick, who's on utter autopilot. He's a man who has done this play 1,000 times, and you can just see the deadness in his eyes as he's reciting his lines and singing the songs yet again and going through the motions of the choreography he knows that he could do in his sleep. And it's sad because he's been in movies. He knows how to act in movies, and he's not doing it here. So, frankly, the entire thing, if you're curious about what the show was like, you might want to go see this just to, you know, satisfy your curiosity. If you're a fan of the play, you might like it just because you like the play so much. I admit I laughed, but I laughed at the source material. I certainly was incredibly unimpressed by the filming of it. And I would have to give it a grudging B minus. I would give it less than that if it wasn't for the fact that the basic material it's based on is so strong that you will laugh. You will enjoy a great deal of it, but it's not a good movie. It's really not.
You know, I agree with like 99% of what you say. And the only place where I would disagree is that Will Ferrell still has not found material stupid enough to match his dubious talent. But this is really close. This is really, I mean, he has two modes of operation, stupid and arrogant stupid. And this is arrogant stupid, and he plays it beautifully. Mm. Everything else to say about this is true. When the initial meeting between Leopold Bloom, who's the uptight accountant, and Max Bialystock, the producer, in the original movie is so hysterical, and Gene Wilder, I mean, to say he nails it, he invented it. He invented all the shtick for this thing, you know, between him and Brooks, the thing with the shred of blanket that he retains from his childhood. And I'm watching Matthew Broderick go through this saying, boy, this guy is no Gene Wilder. Everything, every move is copped from Gene Wilder, and Gene Wilder did it funnier.
Yes.
It's sad, really, because the original movie is one of my favorite movies of all time. It made me want to see the original one more time and go back and you know, check out the source material. I think that if we saw this on Broadway, maybe the first year that it was running, when Lane and Broderick were still fresh with the material, might have been a whole lot better. The production numbers are great, but the songs are weak. If you take the songs and you listen to them, it's Broadway songwriting by software. You know, there's a software program, how to write a Broadway song, and that's what Brooks used to do this. And for Brooks, that's really sad. I mean, he's an old man now. Maybe he just doesn't have the chops anymore.
And I like to mention, one of the worst songs is the song that Uma Thurman sings, which she sings very well.
She's very good.
But the fact is, she comes on, she's the Swedish secretary, and her song is completely pointless. It's completely out of character. It does nothing to further the plot along at all. And the fact that during her dance number, she's very obviously doubled by a dance double.
Yeah.
So it's awkward and it's unfortunate. And on stage it was kind of good because you'll pretty much accept anything in a Broadway musical on stage. But in a film you're like, wait a minute, she could barely speak English a second ago. Now she's like, what the hell? It was awful.
Ulla dance now.
Yes.
Yeah. if you're really, really desperate to see this movie, I say go see it. Otherwise, you know, save your money because you could put it somewhere else. I give the movie a C+, and that's. You know, Roger Bart is great. I have to say, Roger Bart is great. If you remember him from Desperate Housewives, you're really not going to believe what you see on the screen.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Okay. That was The Producers. Ah, alas, poor Mel Brooks. I knew you. Munich. You didn't see Munich, huh?
I did not see Munich.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a shame. I kind of wish I had somebody else to bounce this off of. But Steven Spielberg's latest film, the least Steven Spielberg film I have ever seen, at least since Jaws, which also to me is not...
Even less than the horrible Terminal?
Oh, I didn't even bother to see that. That one stank from a mile away. Stars Eric Bana, Jeffrey Rush, Daniel Craig, Kieran Hines. I know I haven't pronounced the poor man's name right. And Daniel Craig is going to be the next James Bond, and here he plays a South African Jew with blonde hair and blue eyes. Very interesting. This is a very long movie, but it's extremely engrossing. I mean, there's no point in this film where I said, geez, don't I have to go to the bathroom or I looked at my watch or anything. There is all of the preachiness, and you will believe this moral of this film is gone from this film. This is a movie of moral ambiguities, and Spielberg rises above his own shortcomings to let the material do the job for him. He actually lets the material work here. Everything has its price. Bana's, he plays an assassin who is put together in a team with other Israelis to kill the Palestinian militants who killed 11 Israelis at the 1972 Olympics in Munich. And what we see here is a group that's put together, and some of them have doubts right at the beginning as to whether this is a good idea, but by the end, they've basically fallen apart. Their numbers are reduced by death, and sometimes just by lack of heart. They just can't do it anymore. And eventually the Bana character just quits. He says, I can't do this anymore. And he doesn't even want to go back to Israel. They want to give him a cushy job at Mossad. He doesn't want to take it. The Palestinians are treated eminently fairly in this, I think, given the fact that the whole world thinks of them as murderers. They have their reasons, too, and their reasons are given some air. Not as much as the Israeli side, it's true, but at least you understand why they did what they did. You also get the idea that the Israeli assassin team went out of their way not to injure anybody who was not directly involved. There's one scene where my heart was in my throat about a man that they're trying to kill who has a little girl, about 12 years old, and she's running around this apartment in Paris, and they're trying to get her out of the apartment. And just as they're about to blow this guy to kingdom come, she comes running back for a lost school book. It's that whole scene just had me. And you know you're being manipulated, and even at that, the scene had me.
Yeah, that's Spielberg's genius, though.
It is.
Even while you can see him pulling the strings and you know you're being manipulated, you're still sitting there when he's at his best and you're going, damn you, Spielberg, damn you,
yes.
As the tears well up in your eyes.
This is the best Steven Spielberg film in years and years. I give it an A-. Whatever side you take on this, so whatever, however you feel this thing has been coming down over the years, the thing that this movie is trying to say is that it's not any different now. All of the sides are still in place. All of the doubts are still in place, and all of the moral ambiguities are still in place. A-minus film, Steven Spielberg's Munich. Wolf Creek.
Ulla Dance in Wolf Creek. Wolf Creek is an Australian horror film that was directed and stars people that you've never heard of, so I'm not even going to bother to tell you who they are. It's been getting rave reviews on the festival circuit, and the main reason for that is because it is absolutely beautifully photographed. So it looks very slick and very professional, and it's got this marvelous eerie score. And it takes place in the Australian outback, three backpacking, I guess, teenagers. It's very iffy as to how old they are or what they're even doing there. But they're three young folk on a backpacking trip, and they're headed out through the outback, and their car breaks down, and they get help from this wacky Crocodile Dundee type out in the middle of nowhere, who turns out to be a crazy maniac who decides to kill them all. The film is ostensibly based on a true story. Apparently many people disappear each year in the outback and never seen again. This is based on a true story of three people who were...
Were they eaten by dingoes?
Dingoes ate their babies.
Yes.
They were... But there was this trio, and the two girls disappeared, and the guy came back, and he told this story about this crazy guy, and then he stood trial for their murder for a while, and he got off, and they decided he didn't do it. So they don't really know what happened to these girls, because he didn't know what happened to these girls. So this movie presupposes that they were the victim of some Texas chainsaw massacre crazy man who chases them around and tortures them and does terrible things to them while they scream. And basically, there's a point in this film after this incredibly long lead-in of them being on the road trip and driving around and going through this beautiful scenery, and you know something's going to happen, and they meet the guy. And when things start to go wrong, you realize this movie isn't about anything. This is a movie about people running around and being chased and screaming. And it's the same old slasher crap. I have no, and plus it's even more irresponsible because they're essentially taking a true story of some tragedy, something that actually happened to some people, and they're turning it into cheap exploitation. So it's just awful. It offers nothing new to the genre. It offers nothing new to the viewer. It's just kind of stupid and it tense without any point. And then the movie's over, you leave the theater and you go, okay, so? I give it a C-, and I'd say that I'm only giving it that high of a score because it's really pretty to look at. It can fool you into thinking it's a much better movie than it is because it's shot so well. But there's nothing there.
Gee whiz, so maybe Sven Nyquist is the real Ingmar Bergman. Okay, so that was Wolf Creek. An Israeli film, Campfire. It's actually a last year's film. I think it's going to be showing at the Hollywood. Directed by a man named Joseph Cedar. It's got a cast, though you never heard of any of these people, but I'll mention the name anyway. Michaela Eschet, Honey Furstenberg, Maya Marone, and Moshe Ivgi. Great name. This is sexism, classism, and just plain snobbery among Israeli settlers in 1981, and I think it's set there for a reason. This is when a lot of the settlements were just being built in quote-unquote Palestinian territory, and They were more exclusive. If you try to get an apartment in the Dakota, you're not looked at any closer than you are trying to get into one of these settlements. They want people who are committed to the cause of being a settler. That was one of their causes. This is Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. want people who are religious Jews, so you have to have be a religious Jew, and you also have to fit in. Now, what does fit in mean? Fit in means that you have to be of a certain income level. You have to have a certain social cachet.
You have to have the diamond-studded mezuzah?
Not quite the diamond-studded mezuzah, but these people are snobs. They're religious snobs, they're social snobs, they're economic snobs. So this is, sexism, classism, snobbery, racism, because the darker-skinned Jews, the Jews who try to come into these settlements from people who have come from North Africa, they're looked down on also, and they're kind of ostracized by the... This is the dark underbelly of the Jewish experience in Israel. So we have a young widow. She's in her early 40s. She's got two teenage girls. The older girl is already sexually active and a total rebel. The younger girl she's at the confused age. She's 15 years old. She doesn't know what's happening to her, but she's still a good girl. Well, they have to come to terms with their own lives. They have to come to terms with their own emerging sexuality because the mother was in a loveless marriage. The one daughter is already, screwing guys in her room, and the young girl is mauled by some of the kids in this group. So they have to come to terms with this and also with the society they're trying to enter into this thing. It's totally loaded deck. Yeah, the director of the film, Joseph Seder, obviously has contempt for the settler movement and contempt for everything they stand for. But yet I found this fascinating as a look inside the Israeli society. And also it has the classic indie movie thing of the biggish schlub, the guy who drives a bus, who's been dating the mother, turns out to be a nobleman in disguise, he's the white knight in this film. That's all right. I found it more fascinating than anything else. I gave it a B. That's, Campfire. And it's going to be at the Hollywood. Now, this is one you took for us also. The Family Stone. Tell us about The Family Stone.
Well, I'll see if I can remember much about it. Just to tell our listeners that I'm a little woozy. It's like 90 degrees in this studio. We could be doing hot Pilates in here. So if I forget anything about this movie, it's because I'm about to, tip over in my chair.
I had hot Pilates for breakfast. How did you know that?
It's a lot of fiber.
Yeah.
Family Stone is it's just a mess. It's a kind of a Christmas comedy, starring Dermot Mulroney, not Dylan McDermott, not to be confused with Dylan McDermott. Dermot Mulroney is a man who brings his girlfriend home to see the family, played by Sarah Jessica Parker. Mom is, Diane Keaton in full, high-strung, liberal, crazy person mode. Dad is more down to earth, Craig T. Nelson. Sister is, what's her name? Who was in the,
Rachel McAdams.
McAdams. She's in everything right now. And, darned if, and they're all supposedly, I guess, quirky and lovable and fabulous. And, the new girlfriend has got a big stick up her butt and she's high strung. And so they immediately take a dislike to her and she doesn't get along with any of them. And, then wacky hijinks ensue when everyone's being mean to the new girlfriend and she gets along with the stoner brother played by one of the Owens. And, Luke Wilson, actually, no, the Owens.
Yeah.
I just think it's the Owens.
Owen Wilson. Yeah.
Luke Wilson. And then Sarah Jessica Parker's sister shows up played by Claire Danes and she and Dermot Mulroney are attracted to each other. And the thing is about this film, I wasn't sure what I was supposed to think about it because I think we're supposed to like this family. Mom, of course, is dying of breast cancer because that's, you gotta have that. And there's a brother who's deaf and gay and dating a black man. And, they're also very, very liberal and supposed to be quirky and charming. But the fact is, as soon as the girlfriend walks in the door, they hate her and they treat her like crap. And she's already nervous anyway. And these people are not making it any easier. And there's no reason for it. We're given no character development, so we don't even know why they're being such jerks. And I kept sitting in the film going, am I supposed to like them? Because I don't. These are horrible people. Every single one of them is a horrible, horrible person. And I don't care what happens to them because I don't like any of them. They're all smug and self-righteous, and there's this horrible scene where they kind of basically bait Sarah Jessica Parker into saying these sort of semi-racist, kind of semi-homophobic things that she doesn't mean to be racist or homophobic, but they all jump down her throat about it, and she leaves the table in tears. And it's supposed to be funny? I have no idea.
Who directed this mess?
I don't remember. It's an awful movie. It's just an awful movie about awful people that you don't care anything about that just wraps up in the most trite, predictable way imaginable. I give it a D. It's just stay away from this film. It's horrible. Absolutely terrible.
Family Stone. Yes. Gee, you stole my word for the next movie. Next movie is a little indie film entitled Down to the Bone, directed by Deborah Granick. It's her first feature film. Stars Vera Farmiga, who is apparently Flavor of the Month indie girl. She played the daughter of the presidential candidate in the remake of Manchurian Candidate. Ah. Yeah. It also stars Hugh Dillon, Clint Jordan, and Caridad de la Luz, who I want to see in her own movie because she was great. Trite, dull, predictable. It's one of these drug addiction films, and it takes place in a grimy working-class town in upstate New York.
As I said to you before the show, people are still doing drugs?
People are still doing drugs. I've heard that.
Good thing
yeah.
they're making movies about it because we might not know.
Well, the fact that they're still making movies like this indicates that as long as people take drugs, we'll be seeing crap like this. So, and I don't mean to be crass about this. I understand that people have problems. I understand that people... It's a movie about falling off of rehab and losing... She's in a horrible marriage with a jerk, and she really can't. This is Vera Farmiga. Her character really can't break away from her life unless she breaks away from these people, and these people are around her everywhere because that's all there are in this grummy little town in upstate New York. So that's, you know, we understand that. So she goes to rehab and she falls off the wagon, and then she gets arrested, you know, for holding drugs and Vera Farmiga is she's a very appealing. She shows some promise. And the director, I think, might even be showing some. I mean, it's competently filmed, and the director Deborah Granick takes advantage of this crummy little town in every way that she possibly can. But I really think she needs to expand her horizons a little bit. The acting in the film throughout is acceptable. It's fine. It's a typical indie film. I mean, again, this is another film written by Indie Software, you know, Indie Software 101 for how to write an indie movie. I give it a C- because, again, it's so trite and predictable. You know exactly what's going to happen the minute all this starts, but you really don't have to see this movie.
This is one of those weeks where that inspire people to go, you film critics, you don't like anything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is one of those weeks where people should, next time they say, boy, you're so lucky you get to see all these movies. Yeah. Okay, let's go through this quickly. Memoirs of a Geisha, Gorgeous and Empty, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. Yeah, you can go see it, but don't expect much from it. The Producers, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Munich, I think the one movie to see this time, I think. Wolf Creek?
Nah.
Campfire? You know, if you're interested in the Israeli thing, okay. Family Stone?
Stay away. Stay far away.
Okay, and Down to the Bone. On January 11th, we're going to have our Best and Worst show. It's going to be an hour show. You'll be able to call in with your own Best and Worst and your comments about our comments.
Interaction with the public.
Interaction with the public, and it's a good one, too, because the people that call us are great. I've been doing this now for 12 years at this station, and I would like to thank all of the partners I've had so far, Sharon Whitney and Kerry Fall, the two I have now, DK Home and the present Don Taylor, are two of my best partners. I would also like to thank our audience, because we have the best audience, I think, on cable. Thank you all very, very much. We'll see you on the 11th of January, and... keep telling you next year where you should not piss away your money. Thanks a lot, Dawn.
Have a happy New Year.
Have a happy New Year, everyone.